Welcome to the Simmons Energy call focused on the current market trends in E&P space. My name is Spencer Ripstein, and I'm a Managing Director at Simmons, and I'm the Co-Head of Energy Investment Banking here. And I'll also serve as your moderator today. Our panelists today are senior E&P bankers at Simmons, Doug Reynolds, Dallas Griffin, and Robert Urquhart. For those of you who don't know, Simmons recently made a significant investment in the upstream space by adding Doug and Robert, who join us following very successful careers at Scotia. This call today is designed to be about 45 minutes, and as such, we won't have time for questions today. But if you do have any follow-up questions, I would recommend you reach out to a Simmons representative to get those questions answered. This call cannot be referenced in any articles, and this conversation should be considered off the record. We'll go ahead and kick things off here. Doug, why don't we start with you? What do you expect for corporate consolidation in the coming months or years?
Thanks, Spencer. Thanks for organizing and hosting the call, and thanks for keeping it off the record so we can actually speak openly. Greetings, everyone. Robert and I joined, and we're beefing up an upstream group here, adding the capabilities that existed within the bank. It's frankly a great time to be starting a new business and growing a new business in the upstream. There's obviously significant M&A activity occurring that we've all seen in the papers in recent weeks. And frankly, we see more to come, and we see a busy 2021 emerging in both kind of asset and corporate deals. So you asked kind of about corporate deals in particular. We don't think that this wave of activity has really run its course. We've seen six deals announced in the past 12 months, including two at the back half or the back part of 2019. Seven deals if you include the Parsley sale that's been reported by the Journal this morning, and these total up over $40 billion. We're aware and expect at least one deal coming soon, you know, the next 30 days or so. More than that are under active dialogue, and there's probably three or four that should occur before year end, but may or may not, depending on the pace of negotiations. Driven by, I say, three things. One, a need for high-quality inventory and high-quality projects is actually driving, you know, I don't think you buy Concho unless you want high-quality inventory because it's got a ton of it. Second, opportunity to reduce costs, which is very significant, just like the cost reductions that occurred in the merger wave in the late 90s. The industry, thanks to much lower commodity prices over the last five, 6 years, needs to reduce costs and is addressing that very aggressively. And then thirdly, scale. Companies need to achieve some amount of scale to be relevant to investors. When Exxon is now, you know, a fraction of the biggest of the market cap of the biggest company in the U.S., and the entire upstream space, including the majors, is much less than an Apple in market cap. You know, that's a challenge just to be on the radar screen. So the targeted companies, whether it's WPX, Concho, Parsley, Noble, you know, are among the more successful in our sector with great kind of projects and industry and inventory. I found also the synergies pretty interesting. We've seen, you know, about $2 billion of synergies announced across the deals that have been announced. That's, you know, well over the traditional metric where, you know, bankers typically assume kind of 50% of target G&A is kind of a synergy number. In some cases, a multiple of target G&A is coming out. Devon announced $575 million of cost savings, and that's just a staggering number because it's you know, over three times WPX's annual G&A run rate. They're getting that through G&A, but they're also getting it through operating synergies and they cited financing costs. In the Concho deal, $500 million, in which includes a significant amount of exploration costs globally that they won't need to pursue because of the inventory add that they're adding in the Delaware through that asset. So, you know, I think these we're going to see more deals just driven by economic need.
Good. That's helpful. Great. Robert, I'm going to go ahead and transition a question over to you. What do you expect to see on the asset consolidation and A&D front going forward?
Sure. Thanks, Spencer. First, I'll just say as well that I'm happy to be here, and it's great to be a part of the Simmons team. On the asset consolidation side, I think it's important to really look back at both corporate and asset deals over the last 10 years. In the average yearly volume is about $70 billion. That's really split on average about 50-50 between corporate and asset. That has trended to be much more heavily weighted to corporate, as Doug was referencing, over the last 2 years. But at the end of the day, I think it works out to be pretty evenly split over time. So if we're looking over the next handful of years, our expectation, though, is that the pure asset activity, so not public corporate deals, will pick back up and over time will trend more towards the historical average, but it's going to be the corporate activity that's going to lead things for at least a while here. When I think about that, I'm not trying to make this seem overly simple, and Doug kind of referenced why some of these corporate deals are happening, but if you think about them in relation to the asset deals, you do have a couple things working in the favor of getting corporate deals done. One that I think of is just you have a starting point for valuation out of the gates, just with a public marker typically from both buyer and seller as a starting point for valuation. And then as Doug mentioned, just being able to eliminate corporate overhead and increase cash flow for the target out of the gates really has a huge impact. And when you think about asset deals, typically G&A is not a big assumption as a part of an asset deal outside of field G&A. So that's part of the reason we're seeing, you know, more corporate activity. I think we'll still see a lot of asset deals. As Doug was mentioning, there is a lot of discussions going on. I think there'll be some meaningful asset deals specifically being announced here in the next few months. When I think about what deals will transact, I think it really comes down to the highest quality inventory, as Doug was referencing. I think I sort of view that as what are the desirable assets, and those will be the ones that transact. And when I think about desirable assets, I'm talking about assets that can fit this sort of new capital allocation framework, this sort of 60 to 70% CapEx spend of operating cash flow or EBITDA, and consistently generate free cash flow. I view this as sort of the Magnolia model, but it's also, you know, a number of companies are shifting to this, and it was even announced when Conoco came out yesterday with the Concho deal, just talking about how they plan to spend going forward. I think the asset activity will be a little maybe less straightforward than we've seen over the past handful of years. I think the sellers selling for cash, either you know straight from a buyer's balance sheet or the buyer goes out and raises in the public market, we're going to see a lot less of those. But in place of that, I think we'll still see a lot of assets get sold into public companies for stock. So the activity is going to happen. I just think it may be for a different currency where the ultimate realization and sale of that stock will just take place over a more gradual time horizon. The other thing I'd say just about activity going forward is there is a lot of dry powder. The bulk of the dry powder is really on the private capital side, which in most cases is on a time clock and will need to be invested. There's also a lot of public companies with liquidity that want to acquire. I think that's a little underestimated. Public companies may have less liquidity than they had a year ago, and the potential for a shrinking bank facility, for instance, but they still want to put money to work. I think a big frustration, whether it's public guys or private guys, is that they have capital and they just haven't been able to put money to work. And they feel like this is the right time. They feel like they don't want to look back and feel like they didn't put capital to work at potentially the bottom of the cycle. I think one last thing just related to the sort of interlinkage here of asset and corporate deals from a corporate consolidation front, with all that's going on, I think those combinations do make it more likely that there'll be asset rationalizations from some of these bigger companies. So post-merger, they look at their assets, reassess what's in their inventory stack, and think about high grading their assets over time, and that'll take time to play out, but I do think it'll drive more supply coming to market on the asset side.
Got it. Thanks, Robert. All right, transitioning over to you, Dallas, for a minute. Obviously, financing market's tough today. How do you see deals getting financed moving forward?
Sure. Great question. I think the answer is, well, it depends, right? And so kind of going down this path, I'd put deals into different buckets. So bucket number one, corporate deals. And I think here the market's been pretty clear. They've very clearly stated their preference for stock-for-stock deals. So new debt financing isn't typically required. An exception to this general rule would be in instances where the debt of the company to be acquired is potentially puttable in a change of control. But generally, new debt financing not required for these deals. Further, I think there could be some nuance here that allows for a seller to receive some cash. For instance, an acquirer could bring in a large equity investor via a PIPE concurrent with M&A, providing the seller with some cash in addition to equity. However, I think the general path forward in these transactions is no new money into the system and a leaner, more profitable company on the other side of the transaction. And I think that's the method of transaction for pretty much everything we've seen over the course of 18, 19, and 20, with a few exceptions. So outside of that, my move to bucket number two, which I would classify as new acquisitions by companies that either don't yet have assets or are currently financially strained. And here, I think the world has changed quite a lot. Commercial banks have been slowly pulling back from the sector for a couple of years. COVID has accelerated this retreat, and in some places more quickly than others. We're seeing that it can be quite challenging for newly funded PE-backed teams to get a new RBL in the current market, particularly if it is being utilized to acquire assets that are either subscale and or out of favor. So sub-$100 million acquisitions can be pretty difficult in quite a lot of instances. I think, broadly, I just say that, over the past decade, the RBL product really has been a tremendous subsidy for this space. And, the lessened availability of financing at L plus 3 is having a significant impact on transactions in the sector. It is, of course, much more attractive for PE to buy at PDP PV20 if it can finance half the purchase at L plus 3. But, those same transactions, if they're funded entirely by equity, might look a little bit different. I would say that, we do think there is a market to address this gap, and that's one area where we've been pretty active. We're having lots of conversations with clients around accessing the alternative lender market, with which we spend a lot of time here at Simmons. And I just say navigating this market is definitely more challenging than talking to your commercial banker, given lender preferences, attention spans, and just competitive tension in the space. In addition to negotiating, the rate and allowable leverage ratios, you're likely to also have conversations around OID, overrides, warrants, the go-forward business plan, cost structure, among other factors. So that's kind of bucket number two. And, to sum it up again, commercial banks stepping back, alternative lenders stepping in. But I'd say that, the cost of capital, varies quite a bit amongst that group. And, I think it takes some skill to navigate and get to financing that really works for acquisitions, and where private equity and or private companies can take on this capital and have a clear runway of how they're going to make money. Bucket number three, I'd say, classify this as new acquisitions by companies that currently own assets but are not financially strained. And I'd say same rules of the road as for bucket number two, But for companies in this group, the commercial banks might be more willing to provide additional financing. And I think just a simple way to think about it, by helping current borrowers acquire the right type of assets at good prices, you know, these banks could be materially improving the financial health of their clients and accordingly the loans that are outstanding with those parties. You know, I'd say the alternative lender group slash market we think is a good stopgap for this group as well. And, you know, I think to that end, we've been spending a lot of time, you know, I'd say on bucket two and bucket three, you know, financing, you know, deals over the past year, and expect that to be a very active area for us in the next year as well.
Great. Thanks, Dallas. Obviously, it's been a tough time to be an investor in the upstream oil and gas space. Doug, do you see investors coming back at any point? And if so, when? And maybe the better question, why?
I guess the answer is yes. So maybe that's it. I'm actually very, very constructive on the upstream sector as a investment destination. And that kind of sounds weird or very strange, perhaps, you know, in a kind of current context in which we find ourselves, you know, stocks having been beaten up, many guys going bankrupt, et cetera. But I see a few things kind of changing or evolving. U.S. volumes are down. I mean, upstream volumes are down maybe 20% since the high in early March, but we're still producing 11 million barrels a day in the United States and nearly 100 BCF a day of gas. You know, those numbers are roughly double where we were a decade ago. So this is a very substantial business that still has massive cash flows. I think investors are going to return, you know, to your question of when. You know, investors will return when the sector demonstrates it can make money consistently and repeatedly. You know, we have seen gas producers, you know, actually up this year. Gas producers went through a very painful period where they had to aggressively look at their costs. You know, I always look at the Appalachia producers, you know, some of which found a way to make money at, you know, a dollar an M or less at the wellhead. That's remarkable kind of cost control up and down the chain. Those type of cost savings are now being addressed by the oil producers. So returns over the last several years have been poor for really two reasons. One, falling prices, kind of as one client of mine said, leg down after leg down. But, you know, oil prices have been coming down for 6 years. And second, stubbornly high costs. You know, costs have been high and are now being addressed, but in kind of three areas, not just G&A, real estate, airplanes, all the kind of things you think about as costs typically, but leverage obligations, obviously huge. There's currently, I think, over $50 billion of debt in the space that's in the bankruptcy courts today. That will all be coming out of the sector, and those historic investors, you know, will be losing money. But on a go-forward basis, as those costs come out, you'll have companies in better shape. And then thirdly, other obligations, including midstream, MVCs, and, you know, long-term kind of structural costs that need to be addressed within these companies. In the good times and in a growth mode, companies took on a lot of costs that today they wish they kind of hadn't. So I feel dramatically better about returns and the returns upside from here based on potential, you know, price maybe heading to the upside and costs being addressed, you know, frankly, sometimes very brutally. So the key now is kind of the new model that Robert referenced, and I think this is why companies will, or why investors will return to the space. We now have a group of companies that, you know, pledge to be generating significant free cash flow at current prices, and they're pivoting from a, you know, a kind of a heavy growth model to much more of a modest growth but distribution focused model. So the new financial discipline around that that model has created a couple of things. One, I think we'll see some dividends start to flow out and dividends be more sustainable. And secondly, it'll allow companies to high grade their capital plans. So, you know, rather than invest in those marginal projects that could generate volume growth, companies will be very much focused on the core of the core in the best basins in the U.S. And frankly, you know, anecdotally, that new math seems to be working. The leading companies are finding a model that will appeal, you know, are finding that this model appeals to investors. And as these mergers are taking place, you'll notice, you know, whether it's Devon or Conoco or others are making that kind of a pledge as an important part of their offering to investors. So I do think that this new return model, focus on free cash flow, focus on distributions, maybe moving away a little bit from growth, high grading CapEx, these are the kinds of things, and maybe hopefully we get a little bit of a, you know, following wind from commodity prices. These are the things that are going to bring investors back to the sector, and you know, it should be a great opportunity for investors to make money coming off the bottom from this summer.
Perfect. Thanks, Doug. Well, this is for the group. You guys decide who answers, but what do you see as private equity's role going forward in the industry?
Yeah, and Spencer, I can start on that. I think the bottom line is that private equity is going to play a major role in the business going forward. I think they have over the last couple decades, and they will continue going forward. I think there's a number of PE guys that may shift to solely focusing on more renewables or transition fuels. But I think there's a long list that will invest in those businesses while also investing in more traditional, you know, upstream, midstream oil field services. I think for upstream specifically, there's still, as I was mentioning before, a lot of dry powder, you know, 10, 20, maybe more billions of dollars in dry powder looking to put money to work. My expectation would be, you know, and I don't mean this flippantly, but I don't think that capital will be given back to the LPs. I think the private equity firms will be motivated to put that money to work. But I think at the same time, the model will be different. The risk thresholds may be higher, and the underwriting of risk and just opportunities generally that will be pursued will be different than the last decade. I think ultimately, PE has done a great job of filling voids within the energy space. You've seen that and seen the capital sort of evolve with the business over the last couple decades. I think one way to describe the energy space right now is it's beginning to, I wouldn't call it starved for capital, but it's in a serious phase of being weaned off sources of capital that have become pretty commonplace, as Dallas was mentioning before. Just thinking about the traditional bank lending market. But you're seeing the traditional bank lenders pulling back from the space. You're seeing public equity investors not screaming to finance the space like they were for a number of years. So you end up with really other capital being in higher demand and becoming the solution, and PE can be a big part of that. I think, you know, we could talk about the SPAC universe and what's been going on there over the last 6 months or even last couple months. Both for all industries and for energy-focused SPACs. I think that's a clear sign of, you know, this already happening with private capital and private capital evolving to appeal to investors and find desirable returns. I think maybe just on this topic, I'll turn to Dallas just to get his thoughts. Dallas touched on this, but he spent a lot of time with private equity and their portfolio companies and has been doing a lot of private capital raise work for our clients. So, Dallas, what's your view, anything to add on what you were talking about earlier, just with private equity's role and how they finance the next phase here?
Yeah, great question, Robert. And I think, first of all, really smart guys in private equity. So, you know, they'll figure out a way to put capital in the system in a way that makes money. And I think you know, there's been a lot of rethinking and retooling of how exactly that works. And I think what we're seeing and might be surprised by what we see out of our private equity friends, but, you know, I think there's a continued role for them to play in buying assets from the publics as they try to get leaner and refocus businesses. We think they'll do that in a well-measured manner where they plan to make money. You know, I think we're seeing quite a few of our friends on the private equity side have at least one team that is devoted to some kind of, you know, private yield co strategy, really focused on, I think, honing that skill set of buying cash flow correctly, which is something maybe we got away from when we were all chasing inventory. So I think that is definitely something we're seeing out of private equity in this current environment. And, you know, I think, frankly, one thing to note, you know, we're seeing this in the M&A consolidation, the focus on reducing G&A. You know, one thing that I think private equity can do exceptionally well is run assets very leanly. And I think when you're building from a team that starts with one employee and you add people as you go, you know, you're really tailor-made for the asset, you know, by the time you get to that deal, you know, that first PDP-focused deal. So I think this private yieldco strategy, you know, that is an area where perhaps private equity can be, you know, cost advantage versus, you know, some of the public guys. And you know, I think other things of note Spencer can talk to in greater detail, but we're also seeing most of these guys, you know, have you know, turning an eye to the energy transition, whether it's, you know, with funds, you know, currently raised or new sidecar funds. And then while it's not, I think, the thing that everybody's focused on to date, you know, somewhere down the road, you know, I think private equity is going to have another opportunity to be, you know, the inventory replacement mechanism for the publics. You know, we like to think about, you know, inventory as not being infinite. And when the publics are about to run out of the really good stuff, they're substantially more willing to do a deal. And I think any deal is better than telling your investor base that from here on out it's all sub-economic, you know, opportunities. So while it's further down the list, I think where private equity is currently focused with new investments, you know, think that there's going to be you know, additional opportunity down the road for private equity, you know, in employing that strategy that they've been so instrumental with in the past.
Perfect. Thank you, Dallas. And then kind of circling back to the question of capital, and this one's for you, Doug. Having just come from Scotia, do you have any thoughts on how commercial banks are changing their views on the sector?
Yeah, I got lots. you know, I think it's pretty challenging out there in corporate banking land, whether you're talking about, you know, the big four U.S. Lenders, the Canadian banks where I came from, or the Europeans who've largely withdrawn from the space, or the smaller guys, the regionals who've taken some pretty big losses, or the foreign banks who, for the most part, you know, whether European or otherwise, who have withdrawn from the space. But they're all facing, you know, kind of three distinct pressures. The, you know, the one that's often talked about is the kind of the political exposure, and I think that's very real. You know, companies are sitting around wondering when the next group of protesters are going to show up at their doorstep, protesting methane emissions or you know, some other aspect of the industry, and so that does have an impact on boards, many of whom have to appear in front of. You know, at least the senior management has to appear in front of Congress and things from time to time. Secondly, the industry is viewed very differently today than 5-10 years ago. You know, then it was viewed as a growth business, so that every asset you invested in, as long as you, you know, as a lender invested in a decent asset, It could be either IPO'd, which meant more fees down the road, or it could ultimately be sold to somebody, which might, you know, might or might not generate fees, but at least it would generate good kind of underlying security that you could point to. You know, today the sector is viewed as more mature, so lenders are looking again, like they did in the 80s, at scenarios where the new owner owns the asset forever. They start thinking more about, you know, blowdown scenarios, about P&A, and about other kind of challenges that over the last decade we really haven't thought about in the industry. And then thirdly, and I would say most importantly, the industry's lost money. And, you know, for many, many years, borrowing base, as Dallas said, was a kind of a subsidized product. You know, it's pretty cheap. You had producers, you know, that were relatively modest in size that were borrowing at, you know, 200-300 over LIBOR. Meanwhile, you know, within the kind of broader space, you know, other industries, widget manufacturers and whatnot, are borrowing at, you know, 500 over LIBOR. And the reason is it was viewed as low-risk capital within the banks. The banks had a super senior position. They had the ability to offer redeterminations, you know, semi-annually plus with a, you know, a voluntary throw if that didn't work. And they also had covenants, of course. And then what happened was, you know, things changed. You know, how many bankers did you hear say, oh, we never lost money on borrowing bases? They went through 15, 16, where the industry went through a big price drop. You know, even though some companies filed for bankruptcy, the losses were borne for the most part by bondholders who were unsecured, not by the secured lenders, you know, which were the commercial banking lenders. And so that, you know, gave everybody perhaps a, you know, mistaken comfort. But now, in this cycle, the banks have taken real hard dollar losses on a number of names that we can often talk about. And so I think this will have a couple of, or, you know, kind of many implications. One is you may see lenders move to be more supportive of larger companies that are closer to kind of something, you know, maybe they're not investment grade, but they're getting closer. They have sufficient scale to have ESG efforts that fit with, you know, with bank requirements. You know, and keep in mind that, you know, that those all involve costs. We may see higher pricing, and we may see that the traditional model in terms of percentage of value or percentage of purchase price breaks down. You know, in this iteration, what we've seen is kind of a rationing of credit where traditionally, you know, you thought about maybe 50% of purchase price, which was a kind of a PDP PV10 number, was something you could borrow from your bank on a borrowing base basis. Now it's more like 30%. And that purchase price is now calculated at PDP, you know, PV 15 or plus. You know, so that big reset, I think, has implications for how much equity is required in deals from sponsors or corporates. And it's that's had, I think, a pretty big impact on the asset market that that Robert's thought about. So I do think that lenders will continue to lend to the sector, but I think they're going to go about it, frankly, quite differently from, this is traditional lenders, from the way that they have in the past. And that, the evolution of that model and the support that companies can get either from the unsecured bond market or from the alternative senior secured lender market is going to, I think, be the way that the debt side of the capital stack evolves. That's my that's my 2 cents.
Perfect. Appreciate that.
Spencer, you know, you've been asking all the questions, so let me ask you a question. You know, you've spent your career, you know, really in the midstream and at the intersection of midstream and upstream. You know, how are you seeing the upstream
companies approaching their midstream assets, and how do you see that market evolving?
Great. No, I appreciate that. And let me just start real quick by, you know, for those of you who don't know, Simmons is a midstream market leader, having done, you know, about 45 deals or so over the last 4 or 5 years. We have a particularly strong track record of working with upstream companies and have done about a dozen deals in the last few years. And in the last 18 months or so, have successfully advised on 5 divestitures of produced water gathering and disposal assets, and we're currently engaged on similar assignments as well. So long track record there. But, you know, more particularly to your point, you know, over the last decade or so, most upstream companies have capitalized on the premium valuation that was there for midstream assets, and they've done that by selling or spinning out those gathering assets and reinvesting the proceeds in the drill bit to some extent. Today, though, decisions, I think, are a bit more complicated, to say the least, and they're complicated by broader corporate transactions, including M&A and potential restructurings. And, you know, as a result, midstream, well, you know, another factor to consider is midstream market valuations have also faced some market headwinds as drilling and volumes have dropped. But upstream ownership of midstream assets still represent a very attractive source of value. And we're finding for the right opportunities where the value uplift still exists, we continue to see upstream guys looking for opportunity to monetize those assets in the midstream space.
And how do you see, you know, I know you're spearheading our renewables effort, growing that business again also here. How do you see renewables impacting the oil and gas business and the oil and gas transaction business over the next decade or so? What's your perspective on that, since it, everybody seems to be asking the question?
It is certainly the hot button today. You know, first of all, Simmons has covered the renewable space for over 10 years. We think our expertise across the energy value chain uniquely positions us to engage with, you know, renewable energy equipment guys, technology companies, and service companies. But to answer your question, when thinking through demand for renewables, we like to put consumption into two buckets, transportation and electricity generation. In terms of transportation, we see the shift to renewables happening, but not quite as quickly as one may think. You know, EV sales today represent about 3% of new vehicle sales worldwide, and are expected to represent, call it, 30% by 2030. You know, key to keep in mind here is that's annual sales, and we have a very large fleet of vehicles on the road today. And, you know, as you think about, you know, the broader fleet on the road, that 30% in annual sales by 2030 still only represents 8% of all vehicles on the road as being electric vehicles. And if you look out even further to 2040, we expect that all new vehicle sales worldwide, roughly 60% will be electric vehicles. At that point, we think that there will be roughly 30% of all the vehicles on the road will be electric vehicles. So by 2030, we think that electric vehicles have the potential to replace about 5 million barrels per day of demand. And by 2040, we think electrical vehicles have the ability to remove about 17 million barrels per day of consumption. So it's happening without a doubt. It's just probably happening a bit slower than we would all think from press releases and headlines we see in California. Now, from an electricity generating perspective, I think you look at renewables as making up about 20% of generating capacity today, and we think that is poised to grow to being roughly 40% or so by 2050, with natural gas making up 38% or 40% today, and we expect that to remain flat. So the big losers here are coal and nuclear that are, you know, are expected to really decline over time. So what's the impact of all the move to renewable that is very real today? on oil and gas companies? Well, as traditional energy capital becomes more selective, we think we'll see more M&A in conventional energy as the sector seeks to kind of right-size the value chain and achieve greater scale. We also expect the lines between conventional and renewable energy companies to continue to blur. We've already seen this with BP, you know, reinventing itself, and with Equinor's investments in the renewable space. We certainly expect to see a similar trend with smaller energy players as well. So that would answer the renewables question. And with that, we are wrapping up our time today. And really appreciate everybody carving out time to join today. And if you, again, as stated earlier, if you have any other follow-up, please don't hesitate to reach out to your Simmons representative. Thank you.